Accession number 26561, reel 14.
Wing Commander Bernard, reel 14. We're talking about your time in the centre camp or compound of Steigluft 3, the NCO's compound. And you've just mentioned that as part of the escape attempts, you were engaged in forging or manufacturing German cap badges or imitations. Well, tell us about this.
Yes, well, they were cast out of a cigarette former, which was melted down, which was very good solder. And also cap badges for myself. When I was promoted in the camp on time basis, I'd been a flight sergeant all that time, and I was promoted to warrant officer, and I hadn't got a warrant officer's Dickie Bird and Eagle, Dickie Bird and Crown. So I found an RAF buckle, which is a pressed brass, and I flattened that out and cut an eagle out of that and hammered it and formed it into an eagle. And I cut the... somebody had an old RAF button and it had a crown on it, and I cut that out. So I had a cap badge that was warrant officer's cap badge. I also hadn't got any identification of being a warrant officer. I just had the tapes. So I took those off, and I made my own, we called them tape and dial, which were the crest of the royal crest for a warrant officer, with the lion and the E and the unicorn. And I sketched these on a piece of paper, and I got some parachute silk cords and dyed them, and the inside of a parachute line has got very fine cords, and I took those out, dyed them the respective colours, and I applied the this transfer onto a piece of black cloth. I don't know where I got it from, somebody's uniform I expect, and stuck it onto the cloth, and then oversewed all the things that I'd sketched. The proper outline of the crown and the was all done. And then you took the tissue paper away, and there you had the embroidery done in there. I also learned to sew and make shoes.
Hang on. Now, this the cap badges, would you have to have an original cap badge to cast it from? This is the German ones.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No. No, I was done
from my
imagination, yes. But,
so they weren't particularly accurate or right, they just
no,
looked...
Yes, I think later on somebody gave me a German belt buckle and I cast that. With gold mittens.
And how realistic did it look?
Oh, from sort of 10 or 12 yards away, 10 feet away, quite good, but of course if you got close up to it, it wasn't up to scratch. And the gold braid was done by winding gold tinsel paper around cotton and so on, and wove it in round that way. And an RAF hat was suitably cap. No, badge was suitably shaped to give a big frontage.
Now, what about, you mentioned the shoes. Tell me about the shoes.
Yeah, so somebody had a pair of flying boots, black leather, that were no longer, the soles fell off after they wore them, and I think for cigarettes or something like that, I acquired these two black leather tops. And I...
Boot tops?
Yes, the cars, fitted the cars, flying boots. And I took those to bits and cut out various pieces and made a slipper-like shoe. And subsequently I learned how to sew leather soles onto Qantas, who was, who Red Cross supplied us with packages of leather, soling leather for shoes, and you soak those in a bucket overnight in water, and then you got a very sharp knife. We always had sharp knives. You ground those on stones and so on. And when they were soft, you would cut a 45 degree cut all the way round where the stitching would go, and eased it back, and made a homemade brad oil from a nail or a piece of jam pail handle again to make a gimlet. You would then make things called tatchet ends, which were a lot of pieces of cotton, cotton reels, and they were waxed and brought together and brought to tapers either end, and then you continued to do a figure of eight loop through the holes, proceeding right round. You tacked this onto the shoe you were repairing with a couple of nails, brads, and then you would go figure of eight all the way round there, pulling them tight each time with this waxed, candle waxed thread. And then when you'd finished, you put the flap back on, put it square, and it was sewn onto the shoe.
Now, were you, it sounds almost as if you'd moved into the sort of tailoring department of Escape here, I mean, in a sense. I mean, were you working for the tailoring department or the forging department?
No,
were you doing?
No, that was just for my own requirements.
Now, if we move into the Escape system, and how was the Escape system organised at Sagan? I mean, we heard a bit about how it was organised at
North Camp.
At Bath.
Yes.
But how was it organised in the centre camp?
In the same way. Quite the same. It had the security men from the security cell, I call them. And there would be guards and so on. But I'll come to you later when I explained I didn't like that business. It was too obvious to me, and to the seasoned ferret would know when people were signalling.
But what I mean was there an escape committee? I mean, was all that set up again when you got to...
Yes, but I didn't know where they were going, what they were doing. I didn't get involved in escapes there. I was too busy on the wireless side of things. That was my contribution to me.
Well, let's go back into the wireless thing. Now, we've discussed the first wireless you made, which was largely just a matter of putting together bits that you already
professional
had. In other words, it was really just an assembly or repair job, whichever way you wish to look at it. Cannibalising, anyway.
Yes.
Now, but things start to get more complicated when you get to Sagan.
Sagan was still continued to that, and Johnny Bristow was making things too.
Well, let's talk about Johnny Bristow, because Johnny Bristow has quite a big reputation. I mean, he's well known.
At Centre Camp, yes.
Tell me about the
wasn't,
work.
I was of secondary importance then.
Well, tell me about the role of Johnny Bristow. Was he a flight sergeant or a warrant officer?
He became a warrant officer, like the rest of us, after a long time in the bag. Simply on dead men's shoes, you know. The establishment was filled.
So tell me, what was his role? And tell me a bit, as much as you remember about him, because he is a well-known character.
Oh, I knew him well, yes. Yes, he was good at making things, very good. He built his radio, and it's still in to be seen in the RAF Museum. He built it in he built two, to my knowledge. One was in a gramophone, which could be played, a portable gramophone, wind-up gramophone in the base of that. That was his prime one. And he also built one in a billy can, a camping thing, and you can see that in the museum at the moment. But that was done with a lot of formal radio parts. He had the way of getting parts to assemble them and put them into a tin can and cover the top.
Now, were these parts coming from German, bribed German guards?
Yes, yes.
Or from outside?
No, from bribed German guards. I'll come to another one and when I get to Valeria, of other things.
And so he was building these, and they were there. So what were you doing? Do you see what I mean? You were, because you were also building wireless or radios,
yes,
there.
Yes.
So how did you two work? Did you work together, or was it that you were independently?
Just, independently, yes.
So what radio did you build there? What wireless?
I built an ordinary one in the tongue and grooving of the lining of the hut was tongue and grooving board. And how that was done was there's a tiny little shelf with a photograph on it. But in fact, if you twisted that shelf, there was a knife blade behind it which unlatched and the whole board came down, and I built it vertically inside the cavity behind the...
That sounds similar to the one you built in Bath, was it?
No, the one in Bath was dropped down the chimney.
Right, that's right. Sorry, I'm getting mixed
yeah.
up. And this was with commercial parts again?
Largely, yes.
So what did you have to fill in?
The odd resistor, which was always made out of a toothbrush handle.
Would that work as well?
Yes, it worked fine.
You just connected... Tell me how you did it, sorry.
Well, what one did, we got a piece of toothbrush handle about an inch and a half long or something like that, and you cut a channel in that. Remember, toothbrush handles in those days were celluloid, and you had chamfered holes in either end, and you used washers from cigarette foil in the chamfered holes, and you then got a pencil, a softest pencil you could get, and you rubbed it in this channeling and in the circumference of the chamfered holes, and then you put it in, and you got a small little nut and bolt pinched out of somebody's switch somewhere, and that sort of gave the pressure to the contact, and that was quite... And if it wasn't behaving too badly, you just got a pencil and put some more lead in the groove.
And that worked fine?
It worked fine, yes.
Anything else you had
and
to fill in?
Tuning condensers were made out of... I had various ones. I started with just the cigarette... with razor blades. Bunch of, because they were stiff and the right sort of size. But the problem was that they would get loose in the lead casting that held them, and they didn't, they occasionally touched each other, which they shouldn't do. So I went from two-stage capacitors, variable capacitors. One was made out of a proper-shaped logarithmic pattern of capacity for tuning.
I mean, just getting this straight for the letter. A variable capacitor is the same thing as what a tuner. That is what a tuner is.
Yes. And I got them to give up their wallets that had celluloid transparencies in it, and I interspaced those blades with those so they didn't touch, or they touched through the celluloid things, and I was able to get more capacity of a reliable nature and a correct linear sweep on the tuning lineup. And I then later on used the fine tuning with these more rarefied razor blades, which were able to increase the spacing, but it enabled me to give fine tuning on these very coarse tuning celluloid interspaced tuning capacitors.
Anything else you were manufacturing from scratch?
Yes.
Presumably, you couldn't get the parts, you know. I mean.
That's right. The other thing, the problem with the capacitors for the smoothing thing, the transformer, we wanted 6 volts heating, 6.3 volt heating. So I made a I got a cigar box and made a volt meter, AC/DC volt meter.
How did you do that?
Well, if you put two blades together on a swinging basis with a capacity, they repel each other if you put AC loop around the pair, and that swings them apart, and which swings the needle in the thing. And I calibrated it by the point at which it blew a 6-volt battery bulb as a full-scale deflection, because that's what I wanted, the 6 volts. So I had the voltmeter to get the transformer right, and the transformer wire came. The Germans, all their cables came in what's known as Litzdrahts. That's fine wire, bundles of up to 50 fine wires all in one. It was more economical than a solid one, and from my point of view, it was excellent, because I just took all these single wires and soldered them together, but they were naked, they were bare wires, so I made some, I got some amyl acetate from the doctor and dissolved toothbrush handles, celluloid, in the amyl acetate, and made a sort of varnish out of it. And I put a long plank, or rather a bench seat, and at one end I had a winder, and the other end it went through a little pot with this mixture of dissolved toothbrush handles in there, and as I wound it on, it dried, and there was a good insulation on the bare wire. The laminations were cut for the transformer were cut out of tin cans and interspaced with toothbrush for magnetic hysteresis. You know, this transfer of magnetism between the thing. Although they counteract each other if they touched magnetically. So there was the transformer. Coils were plug-in coils, which were shaving stick holders. They were tubular devices, Erasmic, and the bases of them made very good plug-in bases, and the plug-in sockets were made out of the thin tops of tobacco tins that were sealed with very thin tin, and they were rolled and made into plug-in sockets devices. Homemade washers, and then put it through, fold it back, and you've got a very good plug and socket arrangement then.
It sounds like you were making more and more parts. It sounds like parts were getting less common.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You seem to have much more to make in this one than you did in the early one. I mean.
Oh, yes, that's right.
I mean, you're still not making it from scratch, though.
Not entirely. No, I get the odd parts. I think some odd capacitors, they were easy to smuggle in, the lower grade capacitors. I couldn't get the big ones, the big smoothing ones, but I made those out of some of Christine Knowles' very thin India paper. I had a paper expert who advised me on the thickness and the structure of the, and to grease these wafers of paper and foil, cigarette paper foil. I had to dissolve, use the margarine, but unfortunately the margarine contained a lot of fat, a lot of salt, and to get rid of the salt I had to melt the margarine and plunge it into a bucket of cold water to get rid of the salt, and then collect the scum of fat and reconstitute it again to soak the India paper. But it still was always blowing. Those condensers were always blowing up because they had the mains across them, you see. So what I did was, because that was high voltage on that line, as opposed to the transformer, which provided the heating voltage. Trying to think of how far.
I think we're just talking about the various parts of the wireless you were making.
Yes, the condenser. Oh, yes. And so what I did on this eventually, I knew that inside each telephone, a German telephone, was a tin can, a 2 microfarad condenser, fairly big thing. And I went and smuggled my way into the Commandantura and undid the telephone, because I'd been in the telephone manufacturing business, and opened this, took the can out without unsoldering it, prized the tags that held the innards and everything together, and I took the valuable contents out of the tin can, filled it with sand and sealed it with thing, and shorted the two contacts out, and to represent a flashed condenser, and put the tags back on, and the whole thing looked the same weight and the same thing, but they wouldn't know that the innards had been pinched, which were very valuable to me.
So you were making all these bits. I mean, that took a lot of time.
Oh yes, transformers particularly. You'd cut out transformer laminations with out of tin cans with a pair of nail scissors. Well, that's very painful. It's a long-winded business, and of course you're doing all this on your top bunk, so that if a German came in, he'd just pick up a book as if he were reading a book by a page in the bank. It was put over what you were doing, and he couldn't see it on the top bunk anyway.
Now, you also seem to have made an earphone. Was that later?
That was later, yes.
Okay,
yeah. Yes, I managed to get a real...
Well, we'll come to that, because that's just before you... Yes, it's later on. Now, what else were you... So this seems to have been a lot of what you were doing.
Yeah.
No more tunnelling?
No, I didn't get involved in that. I think probably the cesspit tunnel put me off tunneling.
I mean,
well, I was more useful as a radio maker.
You saw it that way, but did were you also afflicted by claustrophobia worse after your tunneling? I mean, in other words, really been put off it?
Oh no, just biased into not getting involved, and plenty of people are involved in it, you see, so I didn't have to contribute that, because there's plenty of people who had no other skills who could contribute.
Whereas your skills were rare.
Yes.
So anything else about this, about what was going on there? I mean, what happens next is, I think...
I think I should tell you about some brilliant escapes. I'll come to the first one. The theatre was up and going and producing more than amateur shows, very good. You know, they had the time and the effort and everything, so the shows were first class. So much so that the Germans liked to be invited to them. So that what they had a show that was going on, and they'd given the time when it was going to start, and they would come in. With what they were delayed purposely by 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, and they knew that it was one and a half hour's due. But in that, they created an extra quarter of an hour, and in that time, I had a chum, the same chum that used to get me parts, because he was part educated at Heidelberg. And he spoke Hochdeutsch, Alan Morris. He was absolutely brilliant. In fact, he got an MBE for his brilliant work.
We'll come back to him. Yes. Tell us about this escape.
Yes, anyway, Alan Morris and the other brilliant escapee, George Grimson, I'll tell you one of his other escapes later on. They dressed up he was dressed up as a German Hauptmann, in artificially made uniforms, DIY uniforms, and it was dark, and the other one dressed up as a George Crimson, who didn't speak German as well as Alan did. Alan spoke very posh Deutsch, so much so, and he waited his turn. He dressed up with his corporal assistant, George Crimson, and they waited until the gate guard had gone down the other end of his patrol, and then Alan Morris tore him off a strip in Hochdeutsch officer's type of voice and behaviour, and rollicked him for not coming to the gate quick enough. And the guard was very apologetic. Whenever Alan spoke to a guard, the guard came to attention. You know, he had that sort of presence, a six-footer and brilliant, British, thoroughly British, but had the advantage of being secondary educated at Heidelberg. And so he came to, and then the guard came and opened the gate. And the show's going on with the real officers sat in the crowd, of which we'd created the extra quarter of an hour for. And of course, he rollicked the guard for not asking about his passport to get out of the camp. It's a subtle move. And the guard, and Boehner was rattling on his rifle by now, being torn off a strip by this Hochdeutsch officer. And they, two of them, got away. They were caught in the outer parts. And then, of course, as soon as the real officers came, they realised that too many officers had left the camp, and they set out a search party right away. Yes. And now the other brave George Crimson one.